This is the story of Gizmo and the Gremlins. You can read along with me in your book. You will know it is time to turn the page when you hear the chimes ring like this. Let's begin now.
Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Steven Spielberg presents Gremlins. Billy Pelser has a nice home.
Billy, is that you?
Yeah, Mom, it's me.
A nice job. A nice girl.
If you're not doing anything this Thursday night, maybe you'd like to go out on a date with me?
I'd love to.
And loving parents who are about to give him...
You're going
to
like this. No, don't shake it. We're going to have to open it now. We'll wait till Christmas.
The most unusual gift he ever got.
What is it?
No.
It's your new pet.
Come on, Barney, be a good dog. My dad gave it to me.
But there are a few things to keep in mind. If you expose it to the light, you may hurt it. If you get it wet, it will multiply.
All that from water? They got wet?
Yeah, plain water.
And most important, no matter how much they beg, never, never let them eat after midnight. Because when they do, they change.
Rafe.
They become clever. Mischievous.
What's going on here?
And dangerous.
Gremlins, huh? Little monsters.
Right.
Hundreds of them.
Well, I don't know, maybe thousands.
They've been here too. Billy, what are these things? Where do they come from?
Look, I know it sounds crazy, I know. But in a few hours, you're gonna have a major disaster on your hands.
Gremlins, directed by Joe Dante. They'll be expecting you.
Rand Pelser had looked all over Chinatown for an unusual Christmas gift for his son Billy. So when he had entered a musty backstreet shop and seen the exotic furry Mogwai creature, he knew he had found it. Billy, of course, loved the cute little animal and named it Gizmo. Rand told Billy three important rules he had learned in Chinatown about caring for the Mogwai. No bright lights, especially sunlight. No water. And no food after midnight. Otherwise, bad things would happen.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is co-host Supreme, Mr. Rob St. Mary.
It's not easy being green.
Also along this week is our old friend Chris Cummins. Welcome back, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me back, guys.
This week we're talking about the 1984 Joe Dante film Gremlins, and I'm sure we'll be talking about the sequel along the way, maybe even the breakfast cereal, too. As you heard in the intro, don't expose them to light, don't get them wet, and don't feed them after midnight. Three simple rules, damn it, but Billy Pelser can't follow any of them. Yes, when Billy Pelser is given a Mogwai for Christmas, he promptly proves that he can't follow instructions, unleashing a plague of green-skinned gremlins into his hometown. All right, guys, I'm a little older than both of you, I think, so I'm going to go first, age before beauty. I managed to see this one in a theater a few times back when I was 12. Loved it. It was a perfect blend, a little bit, for me, of a kids' movie along with a gross-out horror film. And I'm not sure if it still holds up for me based on its own merits or just because of nostalgia, but regardless, I've got a lot of good feelings towards this film. Now, Chris, as our guest, when did you first see Gremlins, and what are your thoughts on it?
I was 9 when I first saw Gremlins, and I saw it during a family vacation to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. There's a theme park there called Dutch Wonderland, which is it's Dutch Wonderland. It's exactly what you would expect. But attached to Dutch Wonderland, they had a movie theater there. And the only time my family and I really went to the movies was on our vacation, so it was kind of a big deal. And Gremlins had just came out, and none of us really knew much about the movie or what it was like. We just knew, hey, Spielberg, you know, produced it, and it looked kind of cute. I was a kid, I should preface this by saying, who was terrified of everything. I was just a gigantic wuss. Most movies scared the crap out of me. But I went and I saw Gremlins, and I wasn't afraid at all at any point. I mean, I just absolutely loved it from start to finish. The next day, I insisted on having my parents buy me a Gizmo t-shirt. So I have some great pictures of me that vacation just wearing this t-shirt that I refused to take off. I was just so in love with the movie. And to this day, it remains one of my favorite films.
You know you're going to have to scan some of those and send them our way, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I saw this in the theater. I was 6 years old in 1984. And there were three films in the summer of 1984 that I saw, and I will tell you the ones that freaked me out and the ones that didn't. Ghostbusters did not freak me out. Gremlins gave me nightmares. And Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, I freaked out in the movie theater, as I've told this story before, about the scene where the guy gets his heart ripped out. And I just started screaming. So, but Gremlins, I do remember it scared the crap out of me. I don't think when I was watching it, but it was more when I went to bed at night and the lights went out. And everywhere I looked, I saw Gremlins. And I just remember like running to my parents' room and having to sleep with them for a couple nights.
Well, I think there was probably a little bit of a breach of trust, the way that Chris put it, like, you know, it was a Spielberg movie. And at that point, it was like, oh, Spielberg, he made E.T. Yeah, this is great, you know, but people forget that Spielberg made Jaws, you know, which is a really scary movie at points. So it's like, yeah, he's not just like this family-friendly kind of guy, but for some reason, he was starting to get this reputation of being this family film director. Maybe it was just all based on E.T. Close Encounters really isn't that much of a family film, but 1941, I remember going to see that with my family, and I was probably the only one who thought it was funny, but then I was like 9 at the time. So, but yeah, this originally was a lot darker, even what we saw at the theaters. Chris, I remember you wrote about the original screenplay in Cashews to Cinemark years ago. Can you lay it on our audience as far as what that screenplay was like?
You know, it took 8 drafts of the screenplay that Chris Columbus did before, you know, the finished product reached the screen. And I think so much of what makes Gremlins Gremlins are the little flourishes that Joe Dante added to it. Because even the final shooting draft on paper isn't as, you know, you can read about Futterman and what he's up to, but without Dick Miller's performance and Joe Dante's direction, it comes across as pretty dry. So it's a movie that definitely, you know, lives on screen as opposed to on the printed page, if that makes any sense. But the original screenplay, the early drafts, it's in Impossibly Funky, the article, and I forget if it's the second or fourth draft that I actually read and reviewed for the book and for the issue of Cashiers it originally appeared in. But it was a much more brutal and dark script. It was just straight up horror that Columbus was doing. And none of the characters were likable at all. There was just a lot more violence. It was just a lot darker. It was a much angrier type movie. And there was nothing in it that made it recognizable as what we love as Gremlins today. So it's really interesting going back and reading those early drafts, because to me, they always read, like once I read the actual early draft that Columbus wrote, I thought of the Gremlins knockoffs like Ghoulies and Critters, because that's what Gremlins would have felt like had it not had the guiding hand of like Joe Dante and the great cast that he assembled. Gremlins as a horror film doesn't work. Gremlins as a horror comedy works beautifully. And that's mainly because of Dante and the cast he assembled, I feel.
Talk about a reputation of being family friendly. I mean, yeah. Chris Columbus, The Goonies and Young Sherlock Holmes, which has some dark edges, granted. But just like, you know, a lot of the stuff that he's written or directed over the years, it's like, you know, the first couple of Harry Potter films and stuff. It's like he became like kind of the go-to guy for family happy kind of stuff. 9 months. I mean, that's, you know, that's not a kids movie, but still, it's just like, you know, light romantic comedy kind of a thing.
His Saturday morning cartoon, Galaxy High School, which is really, it's actually a really brilliant cartoon and very underrated.
The thing that got me, you know, Rob, you mentioned the director's commentary, the idea that in one of the early drafts, and maybe this was the one that you read, Chris, but or still there in the draft that you read, that Gizmo was going to become a gremlin, you know, would have totally changed the entire trajectory of the film.
Had that happened, obviously there would have been a lot less merchandise. It would have killed that character. Definitely the way the character endeared himself to the audience had he become evil at the end. It would be like if E.T. started killing Elliot and his family in the third act.
I don't know how much of what came to screen was the result of Dante's direction. I'm sure a lot of it is, and kind of the subsequent rewrites of the screenplay and everything, and how much of it was because of Spielberg's influence. It was hilarious listening to that audio commentary and hearing some of the stuff that Dante was doing, almost, I don't want to use the word pandering, but just this kind of like making Steven happy as the executive producer on this. Like the whole idea of putting Watch the Skies and A Boy's Life on the theater marquee, you know, and because people forget that this was the first Amblin film. This was the first one that Spielberg was going out as a producer with. After this, Spielberg like owned the early 80s. We always look at Lucas as far as the influences that Star Wars had and all this kind of stuff, but really Spielberg has a much better track record when it comes to being this kind of behind the scenes guy. You know, he doesn't have, I'm sure he's got some bad eggs in his closet, but he doesn't have a Howard the Duck on his track record. When you look at Spielberg, it's like Back to the Future, he produced The Goonies, Poltergeist, you know, he was on TV with Amazing Stories that we'll be talking to some folks about when it comes to the Eating Raoul episode that we'll do in a little bit. But again, back to young Sherlock Holmes. I mean, there are so many great movies coming out under Spielberg's, you know, umbrella.
The biggest disaster that Spielberg was involved with, I mean, other than 1941, which isn't, you know, which isn't as bad as its reputation suggests, but I mean,
it's still pretty bad,
yeah,
though.
Well, yeah. Obviously, the biggest, you know, blemish on Spielberg's career through no fault of his own was Twilight Zone, the movie, which predates, you know, Gremlins, obviously. That was kind of the most controversial thing just for everyone involved, Dante as well. With Spielberg, that was kind of the only blemish on an otherwise perfect track record that lasted well throughout the 80s, possibly until Hook came out. When he worked in the executive producer, I know the audio commentary Gremlins gets into this a little bit. His role in Gremlins seems to be adding like cutesy moments. Like when Billy finally kisses Kate, it was Spielberg's idea to have Gizmo pop up and kind of cock block Billy. So those kind of little moments in the movie were all Spielberg. That's kind of his lasting influence on Gremlins, other than, you know, helping get the thing bankrolled. But he definitely did own the early 80s. And the thing about Gremlins, this movie, as well as Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, because of the surprising level of violence for a PG movie, these movies didn't really set a precedent, because wasn't Planet of the Apes originally G?
Well, yeah, and even, I believe, Jaws was PG when it came out.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, it's not like the violence was unheard of, but the 80s became PC.
Safe.
Yeah, they were safe, and at that point, it became like, wow, there's a lot of violence in these movies. Kids are going to these movies thinking they are kids' movies, and then there's hearts are being ripped out, you know, monsters are melting from being exposed to sunlight, and a lot of these images that could be considered very troubling for younger viewers. I'm still amazed, like I said earlier, that this movie didn't scare the crap out of me, just given the level of violence that is in Gremlins, but I just thought it was all so cool that I was able to tune out of that and just be wowed by the wonder of it as opposed to freaked out by it. But, yeah, so there's a lot of stuff in, you know, those two movies that were considered questionable. And the MPAA kind of responded to the bitching and moaning of parents and you know, I'm sure theater owners were feeling the anger coming from parents that their kids were crying and upset, and there was this movement to start a rating for that wasn't as hard as R, but not soft as PG. And so we had the PG-13. It's all thanks to Spielberg, for better or worse.
I think it has more to do with the marketing or the name attachment than it had to do with the film. Because if someone would have done the marketing correctly, and I'm putting that in quotes, then nobody would have complained about these films. Because I don't think Jaws was put out there as a kid's film. You know, you could tell from the poster that it was a horror film. I mean, it's there. And with Gremlins, it's like a kid holding the box. It looks a little mysterious, and you see these little furry claws coming out. Now, if you would have saw the green gremlin claws coming out, then maybe it would have been a little different. As for Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, the poster I remember is like him in the transom or the doorway or something like that. And, you know, it's sort of this beautiful painting. And it doesn't look chaotic. It doesn't look bad. And I guess maybe going in, if you knew the first one, then maybe you go, okay, there's face-melting Nazis. Maybe we shouldn't take the six-year-old.
Well, even with the font on the Gremlins poster, I mean, it's such a lovely, bouncy, kind of cloudy font. It's just like with this light blue coloring and stuff. And it's just like, does not say, like, you are going to have the pants scared off of you or your kid is going to have a freak out after you see this kind of thing. This says, like, big, happy, friendly family film. You know, oh, there's something mysterious that's in the box. It's not like, you know, Dune, where it's like, what's in the box? Pain is in the box.
But on the poster, it's like, it's a good thing that's in the box. I mean, it's a little mysterious, but it's like a little furry creature. So when you first see it, when you see that poster, you're like, oh, what is that, a cat? It looks kind of like cat paws, you know?
Let's not forget either that these were both movies, especially Gremlins, that were so heavily merchandised. Like, you know, Jaws, when Jaws first came out, there wasn't merchandise immediately available. And it never was saturated, like a kids' film would be in terms of merchandising. Whereas, you know, Gremlins and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, you could immediately go to Kitty City or Toys R Us afterwards and get yourself like a little gizmo doll or, you know, the Topps trading cards and, you know, relive the terror all over again. You could get those great LGN Gremlins toys that grew in water, and, you know, like, there's all of those items that were available.
I'm looking at one of those right now.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's just like, you know, so parents, again, thought, oh, well, there's all these toys for this movie. It was the biggest misstep in merchandising since Hasbro got the Alien license back in 79. You know, it was just a misstep in many ways. I mean, it gave us a hell of a lot of cool toys, a line of which that continues today with the great stuff NECA's putting out. Parents would be kind of rightfully pissed that these movies were not kids' movies. It's not The Secret of NIMH here we're talking about, our never-ending story. I mean, there's some hardcore scary stuff in that.
They always would show the scene of the mom in the kitchen with the blender and the microwave and all that stuff. And it's funny to think, like, you know, this is a theatrical film where this is going on, and yeah, granted, it is kind of intense and stuff, but I'm thinking of, like, Trilogy of Terror that was on television with that Zuni fetish doll chasing Karen Black around her apartment, and she's throwing the doll in the, you know, there wasn't a blender, but there was an oven and all this kind of stuff, and that's on TV, you know, that's a matter of, like, 5 or 6 years. I mean, have we been, like, that domesticated by Reaganomics and the whole Reagan era, like, just over those first few years? But it kind of almost feels like it was. I mean, when you look at even the difference between Raiders of the Lost Ark and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Dune, I mean, Raiders was pretty darn intense, thinking of, like, that end scene with the Nazis' faces melting and everything. That's almost a little bit more to me than the heart being pulled out of the guy's chest. Maybe it's that they had Short Round and Kate Capshaw and stuff in that film, and so it felt like it was going to be like a little friendlier kind of thing. You know, oh, he's got a cute kid sidekick. Oh my God, they're pulling that guy's heart out of his chest.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's all William Huck and Gloria Katz. I mean, Howard the Duck's like that too in terms of the crazy tonal shifts. I mean, look at how Temple of Doom opens with a fun musical number, and even when Indy's getting poisoned, there's antics aplenty, family-friendly fun. And then it just gets crazy dark after all these scenes of, like, Willie Scott running around screaming. And then next thing you know, monkey brains are being eaten and there's human sacrifice and all hell is breaking loose. And that's just, you know, that's what Huck and Katz did so well, is just, you know, the crazy, crazy tonal shifts in their movies. But yeah, audiences weren't really expecting the stuff that they got from these films.
The examples that kept coming out when I think Siskel and Ebert covered this on their show, and then, you know, news reports and all this kind of stuff. And I mentioned the scene with the mom and the microwave and the blender and all this, and then the scene in Indiana Jones with the heart and all that kind of stuff. We got to remember that not only did these movies come out the same summer, but they actually came out 2 weeks apart. Indiana Jones Temple of Doom was like March 23rd or 4th or something, and then Gremlins was 2 weeks later, like early June 8th, I think it was, when it came out. So it's just like, bam, bam, here you go. Here are these two pretty violent films that Steven Spielberg has his name on, and people are forgetting, you know, that he produced Poltergeist. Going back to the marketing and stuff, it was just like maybe not handled the best. You know, they probably, even with Indiana Jones, they probably focused more on Short Round in the previews.
Hang on, lady, we go for a ride.
The most disturbing scene in Temple of Doom for me was always the insect scene. That made me uneasy. The heart stuff I could deal with and everything else, but that insect scene, forget about it. To this day, I cringe while watching that scene.
I just have problems with the monkey brains. It really reminded me of Faces of Death.
Mike, you bring up, is this Reagan? Is this Reagan's fault? Sure. Did we get really culturally conservative? And the thing that's interesting to me about Gremlins, and I'll say both the first and the second film, we get into the second film later, is that much like The Howling, putting Joe Dante on The Howling, where he takes apart sort of social conventions and certain other things and groups and everything like that, like we were talking about on The Howling episode, is that in Gremlins, there's all this stuff about yuppies and greed and money and, you know, him working at the bank and Judge Reinhold and his character. And then there's the old lady in town who's foreclosing on people's houses during Christmas and she gets her payback. So there's all this stuff about like greed. And in a way, I actually kind of think that maybe even the gremlin creatures themselves are sort of a stand-in for greed.
I really wish that I had the deluxe DVD of this one, because I hear that there are a lot more scenes of the Judge Reinhold character and really a whole lot of just other stuff. I want to say that the original cut of this was well over 2 hours, if not more.
Dante said it was 240 or something like that on the audio commentary. Yeah.
That audio commentary is hilarious to me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Dick Miller is absolutely great on that. I just love that they involved him in it.
Yeah, I love that kind of repartee that Howie Mandel, of all people who I usually cannot stand, right. But him kind of like messing around with Dick Miller on there, I find hilarious. But there's that one part where Dante just shuts down Galligan.
I can say something about this scene, and that is I remember that we had to reshoot it for some reason. Or we had to reschedule it for some reason, so that we shot this scene at like 6:15 a.m. and I was completely exhausted. And
see, this is the kind of commentary I would cut out if I was editing this.
Really? Why?
Well, because
who cares?
Who cares?
I don't know.
But I think it's interesting now that you would tell him that it's not interesting. So that makes it interesting.
It's not interesting because of him. It's just basically not interesting. Even if you said it, it wouldn't be interesting.
I could make it interesting. Something. I think I can make it interesting. I think Dick, you talk about it.
I find it difficult to discuss anything shot at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Well, yeah, I don't really remember much of it.
But I don't see why it would be...
Dick, be quiet for a minute. Let us talk. Please? Enough. Supposed to have... All of us are supposed to have some input here. And
I felt so uncomfortable listening to that. Again, going back to that original screenplay, if there were things, you know, themes that were in there that kind of got eliminated, but it definitely feels like this thing got shaped a lot in the editing room.
I remember the original screenplay when I read it. There really wasn't anything going on. It was just all the characters were cliche, and there wasn't any subtext or any subtlety to anything that was going on. So I definitely feel any of the kind of greed metaphors and everything were added, you know, in the later drafts, and definitely added once Spielberg and Dante got into the mix.
There's a couple of things in here also that I wanted to get into in terms of thematics. I mean, we can talk about the greed aspect, but there's sort of this idealized small town America, which the town itself, and I wouldn't be too surprised to find out that it is, looks kind of like the town in Back to the Future.
Oh, it is. Like, it is that town.
Yeah, it's the same exact shooting location, yeah.
Yeah, so it has that. There's also this sort of, like, I wrote down Capra-esque, and then there's this whole, you know, It's a Wonderful Life, you know, because it's Christmas. So right. That, I think, Dante's going, hey, it's my Capra-esque film, right? So it's small-town America and things like that. The whole thing with the rules, like you were talking about in the beginning, Mike, is, to me, kind of meshes with Dick Miller's character. And what I mean by this is that Dick Miller represents really xenophobic America. You know, he's like, American cars, you know, don't buy those foreign cars, they're crap, you know, which as a Detroiter, I go, yay. And then he talks about sort of like the other, you know, sort of like foreigners and things like this. He's got a couple of things that he says in there that are a little kind of xenophobic. And then at the same time, the idea of the rules, where it's like, we're Americans. Of course, we don't follow the rules. We make our own rules, right? Isn't that what America's always been about since the very beginning? So to me, it's kind of showing us that at the same time. And in the 1980s, I mean, going back a little further, I mean, look at Hoyt Axton's character, right, as the father, the inventor. I mean, to me, that's totally Ron Popeil, and he was on TV all the time hawking all of these little inventions that you could buy, you know, like the pocket fisherman and all that stuff.
None of them worked. I love that, too.
I would still buy a bathroom buddy if that were a real product that were available. I'm kind of sad that no one ever came out with that. That would be a great thing for one of the prop companies who thrive these days to make.
Well, it would make sense if it came out on, like, Think Geek as one of their April Fool's jokes or
exactly.
Something.
Yeah. Get on that, any Think Geekers out there.
I mean, they had that lost alarm clock where you had to reset it every 108 minutes and stuff.
Right. Brilliant.
And then I'm thinking about, okay, well, that whole Chinatown scene in the beginning, I just want to take the tone of the room on this. Did you kind of, even though I know that Key Luke was number one son in the Charlie Chan films, do you kind of find that maybe the Chinatown scene is a tad racist, and that also he kind of represents, I'll call the mystical Asian as sort of the equivalency of the magic Negro?
Definitely, in so many films, Asians represent the other, you know, that mysterious thing that you can put your fears onto and kind of project what you want onto them.
I absolutely agree with that. Between him and Mr. Miyagi, it was a big summer for the mystical Asian character. I feel definitely filled that kind of trope in pop culture, for sure.
I definitely saw it at the end of the film because, and I'm sorry, I'm going to spoil it. It's a 29-year-old film, all right, folks? But where he comes and he takes Gizmo back and he's like, you people never learn, and you people and all this. I mean, he's really kind of like condemning them for the fact that they didn't follow the rules. They didn't do what he told them. You know, you never should have had this thing. You don't deserve it. I'm taking it from you. And to me, it's almost like the magical Negro stereotype, where it's like, I'm the guy from the other group that's going to teach you stupid white people something you need to learn.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Rob. I really think you hit the nail on the head there. He definitely represents the Peltzer family. Okay, guys, you are the typical American, and you need me to teach you how to do things right.
And this is another thing, which I didn't think about this until I went and did some reading on it, you know, getting into the race thing again. Do you see the actual gremlins themselves as possibly racist?
I think I read the same thing, where it was, do they represent young African Americans, you know, the breakdancing, the loud music, all this kind of stuff. And again, this kind of other coming into the white area, because other than the biology teacher, I don't think there are very many people of color in this film.
The biology teacher is the only black character, and he ends up dying. And this here is, I wanted to read this to you because I thought it was interesting. This is from Complex Magazine, which is a hip-hop and fashion magazine. And I'll put the link, I'll share the link with you. It's the 50 most racist movies. And number 50 is Gremlins, and I'll read it to you. It says, the film stars, which spawn from a mystical Asian creature called a Mogwai, are loud, breakdancing little monsters that devour fried chicken at an unprecedented pace, destroy and devalue property, even kill good white folks. But they're not meant to represent black youth, though. Definitely not. They're not scary enough. That's what they wrote.
I've actually heard that a few times before, and I kind of think it's a stretch, and maybe even a little racist itself to even claim that. That's my take on it. I don't know. I just... they're monsters. I can see where that argument can be made, but I'm uncomfortable with that argument. I don't know. That's my personal opinion.
There was another quote that I pulled up, and this one's actually on the Wikipedia page for Gremlins because it talks about this aspect. And it said that Patricia Turner wrote this book called Ceramic Uncles and Celluloid Mammies, and says Gremlins, quote, reflect negative African-American stereotypes in dress and behavior, shown devouring fried chicken with their hands, listening to black music, breakdancing, wearing sunglasses after dark, newsboy caps, common style among African-American males in the 1980s. Which, another thing that I thought was interesting is on the commentary, Dante says is that they're watching TV, they're watching movies, and they're picking up all this behavior, and then they're just parroting it back out, exaggerated. Like, as he said, I think on the commentary, they exaggerate the worst aspects of human behavior. I don't know if this is just him saying, well, this was on MTV at the time, so of course they would have seen it, and that's what they were reflecting.
It's an interesting read on it, but even if the Gremlins were reflecting what was going on with pop culture, I mean, it takes like 5 seconds for some white guy to copy what he sees black youth doing.
Yo, Vanilla, kick it one time, boy!
Think of the Gremlins more as those annoying homeboys kind of thing.
see, to me, the thing is, I don't have a problem with the Gremlin creatures. I think the Gremlin creatures are just soaking up pop culture,
right,
and parroting it back. The one that I found really demeaning, and as I said, nobody talks about, is this mystical Asian character, which when I looked at it again all these years later, because I haven't watched Gremlins in probably like 12 years, I looked at it and I said, wow, this is the mystical Asian. This is like we were talking about, like Mr. Miyagi, or, you know, this is the cousin, you know, the rice-eating cousin of the Magic Negro.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely valid. Like, that I can see, but the Gremlins as a fill-in for any group, I just don't see. But I think you're absolutely right in terms of his character.
And the thing is that he's so stereotypically dressed. I mean, he's got, like, the Fu Manchu going, and he's got the little skull cap, and he's got the clothing, and he speaks in a sort of broken English that, you know. And people go, okay, it's Chinatown. What do you expect, okay? Right. He went to Chinatown. Of course he's going to run into this character. But to me, the ending is the place where to me, it's really like, you dumb white people.
You know, the thing that gets me is that it's almost still okay for that stereotype. Like, looking back at, like, even like Lethal Weapon 4, like, I really had problems with that movie where it was just this kind of anti-Asian kind of thing. And I mean, this is the, you know, I'm trying to remember when Gung Ho was out, but talk about a really anti-Asian film.
I mean, that was 85 or 86. I mean, even go forward, I mean, look at the Hangover films.
Oh, yeah. God.
I mean, it's still kind of there. I mean, he's starting to come out of it. Like, I'm not saying that person. I'm not saying that actor. I'm just saying that character. We're starting to eventually kind of break down that, you know, mystical Eastern, you know, speaking in pidgin English kind of thing. But to me, the thing that's really interesting is that, in a way, and okay, you could say, okay, this is a good balance for the film, is that the old Chinese man balances off Dick Miller's character, Mr. Futterman's xenophobia, and specifically anti-Asian phobia, because, of course, he's a World War II vet. And this, of course, is at the time where Toyota's starting to rise up, the big three's starting to fall in the 80s. And a few years later, you'll remember, like, as you said, Gung Ho, the Japanese start buying all this stuff. They start buying, like, film studios and big buildings in New York, and everyone is afraid of this. At the time, it was a Japanese invasion of money, and now I would say today it's Chinese. You know, everybody talks about how, you know, China is this big power, and we've got to deal with them, and of course they own a bunch of our debt. So it's just interesting to see this. You know, it's almost a 30-year-old film, and there are contemporary things that the Dick Miller character will say that you'll hear people say.
Any discussion of, you know, movies of that era and the negative Asian stereotypes would be incomplete without a discussion of 1984's Long Duk Dong from 16 Candles. Possibly the most offensive Asian character ever presented on screen.
Though that same actor shows up in Gremlins 2, where he's playing a pretty offensive stereotype as well.
And he's also in Gung Ho, I believe.
Yes.
Getty Watanabe.
Why are you betraying your race?
The Asian-American illustrator Adrian Tomine, in one of his collections of mini-comics, actually discusses his thoughts on Getty and the Long Duk Dong character, and it's well worth checking out. I believe it's in his 32 stories graphic novel. If anyone out there wants to pick that up, it's well worth reading his insights on it.
We talked a little bit about the merchandising and all that kind of stuff. I want you to tell folks about the awesome novelization of Gremlins.
Oh, man. The Gremlins novelization is one of my favorite things on this planet. It is just absolutely shithouse bonkers. It's written by this guy named George Gipe, who he's other claim to fame were he wrote the novelizations for Explorers, another Joe Dante film, and Back to the Future. I never read the Explorers one. The Back to the Future one is insane as well. But the thing about Gremlins is it opens up, and two pages in, it's already a trip to Insanityville. Because I'm just going to read you a little sentence, a little paragraph here, because he explains what the deal is with the Gremlins and where they come from and everything. And this is just fascinating to me. All right, so here we go. This is from the Gremlins novelization by George Gipe. Centuries ago on another planet, Mogtermen had set out to produce a creature that was adaptable to any climate and condition, one that could easily reproduce itself, was gentle, and highly intelligent. Exactly why Mogtermen embarked on this venture is not known, except that such inventors flourished during an era of widespread experimentation in the field of species creation, an era, it should be added, that passed into disrepute following later unsuccessful attempts to introduce cross-pollination among certain species of crawling carnivores. At first, Mogtermen's experiment had been looked upon as a great success, and he was hailed as the genetic hero of three galaxies. The first sets of Mogwai turned out as planned, although the gentle little beasts had a few drawbacks not foreseen by their creator. Their vast intelligence seemed to interfere with their ability to communicate. Mogtermen said it was because they thought so much faster than they could verbalize, and for some unaccountable reason they were repelled by light. Discounting these deficiencies, the Galactic Powers ordered that the Mogwai be sent to every inhabitable planet in the universe, their purpose being to inspire alien beings with their peaceful spirit and intelligence, and to instruct them in the ways of living without violence and possible extinction.
Wow.
Yeah, as many times as I've seen Gremlin, I never, ever, ever wondered if they came from outer space or not. And it's just so insane that he decides to create this elaborate, possibly drug-fueled backstory for them. The book is just one insane thing after another in there. You really get into the inner life of Gizmo and Mrs. Deagle, but nothing beats the insanity of having this outer space god creating the Mogwai and sending them to every planet in the solar system. If you get a chance, it's about 3 cents plus shipping on Amazon. Everyone should have a copy of this novelization, because it really is just a hell of a fun read.
And you can read that. That's actually The Missing Book from Dianetics by L. Ron Hubbard, just to let you know. The Gremlins novelization.
Yeah, Xenu is the one that created the guy who then created the Mogwai.
Okay, this is the guy behind the guy behind the guy.
But the merchandising is so good. I mean, my uncle, not a big movie guy, didn't have kids, to this day still has his Gizmo doll. Like, he bought it, like, when the film That's came great. Out, like, 30 years ago. And I was going through some of my old stuff and found it was one of a series of five. I only had book two, but it was a storybook and record that was given away with kids' meals at Hardee's. We'll include that on nice. projection-booth.com. You can take a listen to that section of the Gremlins story.
That's great. Yeah, in my kitchen right now, I actually have a framed ad for Gremlin cereal. And that says, satisfy your Gremlin appetite. So that's pretty fun.
Which is bizarre, because watching those commercials, it's, you know, a Mogwai. It's not a Gremlin.
Right.
That's eating that cereal. And a really nappy-looking Mogwai in those commercials, too. Looking a lot more like a Furby than a Mogwai.
Yeah, well, I do have the Gizmo Furby as well, but that's more shameful than anything else, that I spent some money to obtain that. I'm very lonely.
Did you ever get a chance to eat the Gremlin cereal?
Oh, I did. It was horrible.
I do not remember the Gremlin cereal. I do remember that they had a C-3PO cereal that I actually kind of liked.
C-3PO's is great.
All right, before we get too far down this path, I think we should take a break and play back the rest of our interview with Joe Dante. You may have heard that first part back when we covered The Howling. And if you haven't, go ahead and listen to that one, too. You know, just go ahead and we can wait.
Now, it's here. The excitement. The adventure of a new force at breakfast.
We'll call them C-3POs.
New C-3PO cereal from Kellogg's. Twin rings, phased together. For two crunches in every double O. A delicious part of this nutritious breakfast. Now you can experience the taste of Kellogg's C-3POs. A crunchy new force at breakfast.
May the force be with you.
Are you hungry? Hungry as a gremlin? Here's Gremlin Cereal.
Gremlins, gremlins, bite after bite. What a tasty way to satisfy a gremlin appetite.
Gremlins is a deliciously sweet, crunchy cereal that satisfies the hungry little gremlin that's in all of us.
Gremlins, gremlins, bite after bite. What a tasty way to satisfy a gremlin appetite.
Gremlin Cereal is part of this complete breakfast.
Gremlin, yum yum.
Hi. I'm Steven Seagal. That's right, Steven Seagal. And for the past 40 years, in between barbecuing oxen and roasting boar for my insatiable appetite, I never miss an episode of Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid commentaries. Ain't that right, Johnny?
Hi, I'm Dr. Action.
Hi, and I'm the Kick-Ass Kid.
When I'm not watching action films, I'm usually polishing my gun while looking at a bat.
And when I'm not watching action films, I'm normally outside with a harpoon killing puppies.
But usually you can find us both watching 80s, 90s action films. You could follow us on Twitter, Dr. Action Kick-Ass.
You can find us on our main page, which is dractionkickass.blogspot.com.
You can also find us on iTunes and TalkShoe.
Yes, every week we do a commentary on an 80s and 90s action classic, and where we can, we also provide the film so that you can watch along with it.
This podcast explodes.
Hey, where's that baby mama at? I gotta tase somebody.
Return of the Living Podcast.
I think it's enough movies to officially consider her actress extraordinaire. Exactly. Actually, it's quite a long list.
Sarah Nicklin. Sarah, how you doing?
Oh, great, guys. How are you?
What was it about acting that made you decide this is what you wanted to do?
My reasons for wanting to be an actor really had absolutely nothing to do with acting itself. When I was little, I was completely obsessed with the child star Jonathan Taylor Thomas.
Oh my God, he is so hot.
Whoa. Whoa. Hang on. So you were basically my cousin. When I walked into my cousin's room, it was Jonathan Taylor Thomas posters as far as the eye could see.
I knew that if I met him, that we would just fall madly in love with each other and we would get married.
That is my favorite reasoning to get into acting ever.
Find him on iTunes.com and Stitcher.com. Don't have Stitcher? Download the Stitcher app from the Apple Store or Android Market. Also, find them on Facebook.com, as well as on Twitter at 245T-Studios.
You know, I was looking for a little excitement, but I was worried about privacy. And then I found out about Vibrators.com. Vibrators.com has the perfect products for women, and men, and couples. They have helpful suggestions and information on how to make sure you get something just right for you. Plus, for over a decade, Vibrators.com has never played around with your privacy. While other .coms make their money by selling your information, Vibrators.com never has and never will. And when you use the special code BOOTH, that's B-O-O-T-H, at checkout, you'll receive free priority shipping on any order. That's Vibrators.com. Get a little excitement in your life.
How did you get involved with Police Squad?
Again, John Davison had produced Airplane, which, by the way, I turned down. One of the more imbecilic moves of my career. When the Zuckers decided they wanted to do their TV series, I actually got to know them on Rock and Roll High School because they did some second unit on it. When they did the series, they did the first episode, and then they asked me to do the second one, and I did the second one and the last one. There were only six. And it was, I thought, a wonderful show, really funny, brilliantly funny. But it died because it had no laugh track. And it looked so much, they were so specific, making it look like a 60s cop show, starring Leslie Nielsen, no less, that people clicked the channel and they said, oh, a 60s cop show with Leslie Nielsen, and they would click away because they didn't realize it was a comedy.
And so it only and after the first two shellings, they started moving it around on the dial, so nobody knew when it was on. And I think the last episode didn't run for like 4 or 5 months after the previous episode. So it was a major flop. But of course, years later, it was resurrected as The Naked Gun, and it became gigantically popular. Although, to my mind, the movies were never as good as the TV show.
No, I liked the TV show, how tight it was, and just the way that it all came together.
Also, the TV conventions that it was able to satirize. I mean, the double titles and the freeze frames at the end that really weren't freeze frames, and the guy who's too tall to be seen like at university is, you know, I mean, all that stuff was. It was just really funny, and the movies were, they had to sustain 90 minutes, and it's very hard to do that with that kind of humor.
You eventually got involved with Steven Spielberg with Twilight Zone, the movie, and then Gremlins. How did that, how was that relationship, especially since you had kind of parodied Jaws with Piranha?
That relationship was fine. I mean, if it wasn't for having made Piranha, I probably wouldn't have gotten to meet Steven at all, because Universal was very upset that Piranha was coming out against Jaws 2, and they were thinking of getting an injunction against Piranha, and Spielberg apparently said, no, I've seen this movie, it's a parody, it's okay, it's not fine. And then he saw Dee Wallace in The Howling and hired for E.T. So by the time I got to meet him, I didn't realize he already knew who I was. I thought, I you know, when you make movies on that level, you really don't think anybody's noticing.
Now, Gremlins, reading an early draft of that script, that one was really much more of a horror film.
It was. It was originally conceived by Steven as the first entry in his new company, Amblin, and he was going to make a low-budget horror film out of it and shoot it in Oregon and do it non-union and, you know, pinch pennies anywhere he could. And obviously, you know, when we started to look at how we were going to make this stuff look real, it was apparent that we were going to be able to make it for $1.98. And so he went just to Warner Brothers and got more money so that we could make it a studio picture.
And then when was the decision to kind of lighten the tone a little bit?
That basically, I think, came with A, spending more money, and B, once we designed the monsters and saw what they could do and saw how the puppets worked and put them in clothing and things like that, it became much more of a comedy than I think Steven even expected, because he went off to make Indiana Jones, and I was making Gremlins on my own. And basically, we just kept turning it more and more and more into a comedy as we were making it, to the point where I think he was really kind of stunned when he saw the movie and he didn't realize that it was going to be that funny.
It is funny, but there are great moments of horror in that, too. I mean, just the ominous cocoons, you know, you don't know what the heck is going to come out of those things. I just rewatched it recently, and it's like, wow, this is really kind of spooky, you know, in quite a few parts.
Well, it's supposed to be. I mean, it's supposed to be a horror movie for kids.
I have a really stupid question to ask you. When I went to see that movie with my mother in the theater, and we were laughing our heads off when Phoebe Cates was telling the story of how her father passed away, was that supposed to be funny?
Well, that was an interesting aspect of the movie, because the studio never understood that scene. And in fact, the day we ran the dailies, I remember the editor turning to me and saying, this will never be in the movie. But once all was said and done, to me, it sort of encapsulated the duality of the movie, because here's somebody telling a story that's obviously very personal and, you know, very, very hurtful to her about something that happened to her. But it's such a stupid story that it's funny. And so you don't know whether you should laugh, and you don't know whether you should not, you know, whether you should sympathize. And to me, that was the way the movie was supposed to be played. I mean, is this a horror film or is this a comedy? It's funny if somebody slips on a banana peel, but it's not funny if they break their back. That fine line between humor and horror has always interested me. And to me, this scene encapsulated it. But they really hated it. And even after we had a great preview, I mean, a fabulous preview, the kind people seldom get in their careers, they were on me like a cheap suit to cut it out. They said, oh, I got to take that out. If only we could cut that scene out. You know, and I said, look, it runs 55 seconds. If people don't want to see it, they can, by the time they decided they didn't like it, it's going to be over. They can go get popcorn. What's the difference? They said, no, you've got to cut it out. You got to get Spielberg to make you cut it out. So I get called into Steven's office, and he says, well, you know, they really hate this, and they really want it out. And I explained to him what it meant to me and why it was in there. And he said, well, frankly, I don't get it, but it's your movie, so we'll leave it in. And so we left it in, and it became an interesting talking point. for people. Even after the picture was released successfully, there were still rumors afoot that the studio was going to supply footages to the local exchanges so that they could cut the prints.
I always felt very vindicated when I watched Gremlins 2 and you had the scene about Lincoln's birthday in there.
Well, yeah, exactly. You're going to make fun of all the things in Gremlins. You certainly can't leave that out.
What happens in the scene, I was working at the movie theater at the time when it was playing, and I don't know how many people might have given you grief over the years that were working at movie theaters, because I had so many people come out and complain when the film breaks in the film.
How could they possibly get out fast enough to see? I mean, the film breaks, and then a second later, the joke comes on. I mean, it's like, how, there's not time to get out and complain. No, that scene has always been in the movie, except in the VHS release. In the VHS, we shot a different sequence where it looks like your VHS is broken, and John Wayne comes out and chases the Gremlins away. But that only exists on the VHS, and I think it's an extra on the DVD. But the regular prints of the movie all have the film break in them.
Well, I was always happy to see Paul Bartel show up at that point too. What was it like to work with him?
Oh, Paul was one of the first people that I met before. I think I met Paul even before I came out here. I met him at a screening of Private Parts in New York, and he and I and another friend of mine were collaborating on a script at his New Jersey beach house, I remember. And I remember it had a scene where a hemophiliac gets his hand stuck in a garbage disposal.
Fun for the whole family. I recently heard that The Burbs had a slightly different ending at one point. Is that true?
Well, The Burbs had a different ending the first time we ran it. And that ending, I think, may be an extra on the DVD. The problem with The Burbs was that once they hired Tom Hanks, they decided they didn't want to kill him. And the whole ending of the movie was a little Hitchcock twist where we discovered that, yes, they are bad and they're going to drive away in the ambulance and they're going to kill him. And he was right all along. But once they hired Tom, they said, you can't use that ending. So then they said, I said, if we're not going to use that ending, then aren't we going to have to explain what the Klopex have been doing in their basement, which we've been hinting at, but we never explained. They're like, well, make up something. Well, it's not that easy. It's really not that easy to explain what was going on in that basement. So there's an ending where Henry Gibson has a long speech about the suburbs and why people live there, which was fine. It was an okay scene. But for whatever reason, they decided after the first preview that they wanted something with more action. And so we ended up with the gurney rolling down the street and a new ending. You know, but there were actually a couple of more endings because it depended on what was in the trunk of the car. And in one ending that we shot, the trunk of the car is full of cheerleaders. And another ending that we shot, the trunk of the car is full of the garbage men, Bob Picardo and Dick Miller. But we didn't use any of those endings. We ended up using skulls.
I have to say, when I had mentioned that I was going to be talking to you today, The Burbs was the film that people were overwhelmingly saying, you got to ask him about The Burbs. Got to ask him about The Burbs.
That's the one. It's amazing. You know, that picture got such bad reviews when it came out. I mean, really terrible reviews and career-killing reviews. And yet, it was pretty popular in the theaters, but it's amazingly popular on video.
Was that your first time working with Bruce Dern?
That was my first time working with Bruce, yes.
How was he to work with?
Oh, Bruce is fabulous. Mm-hmm. He's great.
I know that you've gone on to work with him quite a few times since then.
I have with a lot of people that I like, but Bruce is a horse of another color. I mean, there's nobody quite like him.
It was really nice to see him show up in the hole as well.
Yeah.
Before we leave Gremlins, I wanted to ask you about, there was a cartoon that was supposed to happen, Gizmo and the Gremlins.
That was when Gremlins 2 bombed, they stopped work on it. But I did see some preliminary stuff. I saw all the designs. I saw the Dick Miller character, which was very cool, which he was going to do the voice for. But I don't think they ever got further than drawings. I don't think they ever recorded anything, or I don't remember even seeing a script.
Have you seen the fan film of some of the Gremlins?
Sasha's film, yes. I tried to get Warner Brothers to put it on the anniversary DVD, and they were just totally not interested.
The Gremlins 2, to me, was another one that I just absolutely loved, and it didn't feel like people were understanding it that well.
Well, Gremlins 2 was a handicap by the fact that it was supposed to come out in May. And then after they already run TV spots and everything, about a week before it was supposed to come out, they decided to pull it back and wait until July to put it up against Dick Tracy, because they were afraid that Dick Tracy was going to make more money than Batman, which was their record holder at the time. And so they literally threw Gremlins 2 against Dick Tracy. And a lot of people thought, wait a minute, didn't I just see TV spots for this like 2 weeks ago? Is this an old movie? Or is what is this? So it just, you know, I mean, the screenings I was at, people were in hysterics, but there just wasn't enough of them. And the picture was, you know, they waited 5 years, which is an awful long time to wait for a sequel. The Ghostbusters 2 had the same problem. You just can't wait that long.
Have you ever seen the Howling sequels?
I saw the second one, or the first. I saw the first sequel, and Christopher Lee apologized to me when I met him. And the other ones, I saw some of the kangaroo one, and then I saw another one that was in a castle.
Mm-hmm.
But and then there was one that was sort of based on the book again, but I've never sat through an entire one of any of them.
Between you and me, you're not missing a whole lot.
No, the marsupials I heard was the best. Well, it's the cleverest idea.
Yeah, and it's just kind of out there. It definitely has that kind of bizarre Australian feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like directing CSI New York? Were you kind of like restricted by the guidelines of the show? Or?
Well, that's, you know, anytime you do an episode of somebody else's show, as opposed to doing Erie, Indiana, which I was the, you know, I did the pilot, and therefore I stuck around for the whole series. And you can actually influence the way things are going. You have a say in the stories and the casting and all that. I mean, it's partly your show. When you have a show like CSI, you come in and everybody else, they have a house style. The actors all know what they're doing because they've done it before. You have to fit into their style. You have to do it the way that they usually do it. You can't suddenly come in and say, well, I want to do it all in slow motion. You have to use whatever specifics that they use. And so it's adapting yourself to that style.
Why did it take so long for The Hole to finally come out?
I don't really regard it as having come out at all. You know, I talked them into making it in 3D, and then when it came time to release the movie, the market was flooded with fake 3D movies with big stars, and we lost our window of opportunity. We had no stars. We were just 3D, and there weren't that many theaters then anyway. And then over the years, it just became, oh, that movie, the movie that never came out, you know. So there was an attempt to, last year, there was an attempt to open it in Atlanta and 4 theaters or something. At the same time, it went on VOD, and of course, it was no publicity, and nobody had ever heard of it, and it didn't do anything. And so it was never really, quote, released. It's a VOD item. And it's not, there is a DVD, although I've never seen it on anybody's shelf, and I presume you can get it on Netflix or something, but, you know, it's not in rotation on the cable channels or anything like that. I mean, it's really a movie that's pretty obscure.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's how I saw it, was on Netflix, and it was great to see, but it was just one of those, like, frustrating, why wasn't I able to see this
if
before?
If you thought it was frustrating, imagine how I felt. You didn't even see it until 3 years after I shot it.
When it played in festivals and stuff, I hear that it got great reception.
No, it was very popular. People liked it. You know, I think it convinced Ang Lee to shoot Life of Pi in 3D because when I ran it in Venice, he and I were on the jury together, and he was very impressed with the 3D, and he was I'm thinking about something of my own to do in 3D. And of course, I don't know if you've seen the movie, but it's one of the great 3D movies of all time.
You know, they were supposed to show it in 3D when I saw it. I saw it at one of those Oscar marathons, and I got in there. They gave us the 3D glasses, and they said, oh, sorry, no, 2D.
Oh, no. It's really, the use of 3D in it is really astonishing.
Well, yeah, just some of those shots, seeing the uncle going across the pool and everything. I was like, God.
Well, even the abstract stuff. And there's a sequence where there's these flying fish, and they're flying at you and flying out into the audience and everything. And what he does is he surreptitiously changes the size of the frame so that the fish can break the frame and go out over the black area. And it's really quite an effect. It's really very, he's a very clever guy.
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.